I reversed my order today. If you see on your sheet, it's backwards. My person of significance is a little different today. I picked a musician, and Johann Sebastian Bach. You've all heard of him? Oddly enough, he wasn't famous in his lifetime. He was known chiefly for his ability to play the organ while he was alive, not for his ability to compose. He was a very dedicated Christian. What drew me to him was some of the quotes that I found. I don't have time to read many, but just a few of them that I liked. And, of course, the one from, if you watch the Francis Schaeffer movies, you might remember that one. But it said, "Music is an agreeable harmony for the honor of God and the permissible delights of the soul." For him, music was always intertwined with his faith. "I play the notes as they are written, but it is God who makes the music. The final aim and reason of all music is nothing other than the glorification of God and the refreshment of the spirit." You guys find music refreshing sometimes? It can be very refreshing and can help us focus on God. And then he signed much of his work, "Sole Deo Gloria," which means "to God alone be the glory." And it's nice to see somebody who was incredibly gifted. I mean, the man was a genius. For a while, he was composing one cantata a week. He died pretty poor because he wasn't famous while he was alive. All his music was given out to different members of the family, dispersed that way, so much of it was lost forever. Some of it, they have record of it being performed, but they have no copy of it. Another thing I found interesting as I looked through his life was an article on faith, atheism, and Johann Sebastian Bach, which is an interesting title. It caught my eye. And they interviewed several atheists. And of a couple of them, of particular that they went into, they said, "We can be atheists as long as we don't listen to the music of Johann Sebastian Bach," which is a very interesting. Now, I take that as a compliment to his faith and his practice. I wonder if anybody could say that about us. Many of you have your own little businesses, your own workplace. Do your friends say, "I could be atheist except for the plumbing of, or the carpentry of, or the flight, or, you know, the public service," or whatever it is? We do affect people more than we know, and people watch that, and it has a lasting effect. So I like his music because it has closure, it has happy endings, and, you know, and so it's worth reading his life story. Incredible, incredible life. I hope you had a good week. I hope your faith this week wasn't bullied too much. Anybody have their faith bullied at all this week? Good. Maybe. Maybe you should have been someplace where your faith got bullied a little bit. Last week we finished up our Easter topic, which was the what did they do with the veil? Do you remember that? What did they do with it? After it tore from top to bottom, did they mend it? Did they replace it? How did they cover up the fact that we now had a very close relationship with God? And it was a gift that was given to us through the death of Christ. When the veil was torn, our personal irresponsibility was challenged. Meaning no longer could we be irresponsible. We now had to be responsible for our faith. I was talking to a believer recently who belongs to a part of the body of Christ that has a strong central leadership. And this person said, "I don't know why anyone would want to make their own choices. I want someone to tell me what to do." What do you think? I can understand that viewpoint because there are times when I wish I didn't have to walk by faith. I wish that God gave me a computer readout and I just got it and I didn't fail because I knew I didn't fail because I checked off everything throughout the day. Any checklist people out there? I'm not allowed to talk about my wife very often, but she's a checklist person. A really good one. No. And she says if she does extra things, she adds them and then checks them off too. You do that? Okay. So you checklist people know these things. But see, we do have that responsibility. We do have those choices. And that is the journey of faith. But our faith doesn't mature until it's our journey, not somebody else's journey, right? When the veil was torn, we got to go directly to God to get to be close to Him like it was in the garden. If we didn't have that closeness, we'd still be wandering around under the law. And remember, we said, don't mend the veil. But remember in those Francis Schaeffer movies, the ones that we saw, they put a screen up there. Do you remember that? They saw that screen that keep you away from God again. You're not allowed to get close and personal with Him. One of the results of the Reformation was those screens were removed to remind us once again that we have that close relationship with Him. So, one other thing I would urge you to do, I didn't bring it up before or on Easter because I didn't want to ruin your holiday, but there's many parts of Easter that are not specifically Christian and are relatively pagan. And this might be a good time after the season to kind of study those as a family and decide, you know, is this something that we want in our tradition, or is this something that would be better not to have in our tradition? I've not been to the Sistine Chapel, but they say when you go in and look up on the ceiling, there's pagan gods here and biblical gods here all painted on the same ceiling. How does that work, that they're all mixed together on the same ceiling of a church building? It might be a good time to look at that and say, yeah, we want this to be a part, and we don't want that to be a part. And where did that name Easter come from in the beginning, in the first place? If you haven't ever studied that, that would be a good personal study for you. But we're going to get back into Matthew, where we've been studying for several weeks. We're going to return to the sheet that I gave you, or you picked up when you came in, if you wanted one. We're in Matthew 6. We had just finished a section, and I gave you an outline the last time we talked in Matthew. And I'm sure that you all put that outline to memory, so I won't have to review that. But I'm just going to end with the last verse of that section, just for the transition. I'm not going to go into that last verse. And that was verse 16 of chapter 6. Remember, the outline was comparing, lots of comparisons between what God wanted, a personal, private relationship with the person, and he's talking to the children of Israel here, and what they continually kept doing, which was a public show for their own glory. So he kept comparing these two diametrically opposed, one the kingdom of man, one the kingdom of heaven. And this was the last one. When you fast, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward, but you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who is in the secret place. And so your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Now remember, Matthew, the author here, is building an argument that the Jewish nation had lost its focus, that God no longer was pleased with what they were doing. What they were doing was actually an offense to Him. So we're going to move into the next section, which is verses 19 through 24. And there's three little paragraphs in this section. And at first glance, if I just let you read through them, you would probably understand them well. But by the time I'm done, I hope to have you thoroughly confused. So, well, not really, but because the longer I studied it, the deeper it got and a little more challenging it got for me to understand. So I'm going to read them. The first It says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The next paragraph says, the lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And then the last paragraph, no one can serve two masters, for he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, if you look at the last one, you see he's talking about God and mammon. And we'll look into the definition of mammon. It carries the idea of a god of wealth, a god of things. And if you look at the first paragraph, you'll see that it talks about treasures, valuing in heaven as opposed to treasures on earth. So if you have one at the beginning and one at the end that is talking about treasuring, and then you have a parable in the middle, it would seem like the parable in the middle is helping to us to understand the statements at the beginning and the end. So we have to keep in the idea that it is about treasuring and heart attitude toward things as opposed to some other disjointed paragraph or parable. We have three comparisons. In the first paragraph there, we have a comparison of treasures in heaven versus treasures on earth. And the second one, it might be tempting to say that it's a comparison between light and darkness, but I think it's really a comparison between a good eye and a bad eye. And the third one is a comparison between God and mammon. So let's go back to the first paragraph and look at that for a moment or two. Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Now, as I started to look at this, I did good on the word do. I knew what that meant. And I did good on the word not. But I got in trouble on the word lay. Do not lay. And some versions say, do not store up for yourself treasures on earth. But if you study carefully the context in the original, it is not a matter of asking you not to store up things. See, the statement, do not store things, is a very difficult statement to try to understand. If I say, do not store up things, well, how many things? Can I store up one thing? Well, that's singular, so that's okay. But I can't store up two things or five things. Can I have five cans of corn in case of world famine? You know, or can I have 10 cans? What does that mean to store up? And see, there is the mindset we get into if we interpret it as storing up or laying up. But the better translation, I believe, is to not treasure up. Lay up is to lay up there, believe it or not, is the same word as treasures, only the lay up is the verb form of it, and treasures is the noun form. So what he's saying is, do not treasure up treasures on earth, or do not treasure your treasures on earth. They are not to be the focal point, the affection of your heart. So he's not telling you can't have a few things. So I knew a guy, or I didn't know him. I heard of a guy who decided that this meant you shouldn't have anything. So he started getting rid of everything because he didn't want to treasure up anything or lay up anything. So he kept getting rid of things, and he got rid of, you know, all of his possessions. Pretty soon he had one change of clothes and a bucket. And he needed the bucket to wash his clothes, he figured. But I thought he could have washed the clothes in a stream and didn't need the bucket. So I thought he was laying up treasures for himself, you know. And they were long pants. They could have been short. See, there's no end to the game that you play if you start the treasure up game. He's not after discussing what you have. Many of the commentators that I looked in here kept saying, this is about money. It's not about money. It's about your heart attitude toward the things that you have in your life. Is this where your treasure is? At Christmas, I shared the story of having, when I was a little kid, we weren't rich, and you'd have the presents under the tree. And you, if you remember this, I said, Lord, please don't come back until at least Christmas afternoon, because I really want to open these presents. You know, I don't think God took offense because I was young. I didn't do that this Christmas. If I would have done it this Christmas, he might have said, isn't it time to grow up a little there, young man, old man? So, see, what am I treasuring? If I don't share my faith because someone might think poorly of me, now I'm treasuring their opinion over me more than I should be treasuring the things of heaven, the kingdom of heaven. So there is the challenges for us to not treasure up our treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy. It was very easy for the Jews to fall into the habit of treasuring up. They'd been a persecuted nation for a long time. We know that from the Judges, from all those stories, Gideon hiding just to grind a little wheat. To have resources was security for them. And he's not attacking what your resources are, but he is attacking the idea that they are your security and that God isn't your security. And we know that. I think this generation knows it more than many generations, because we know that no matter how much you save or set aside, it could be gone quickly, right? Previous generations thought if they saved it, they'll have it. Not necessarily now in our generation. Remember, Matthew's trying to get them to think deeper. The kingdom of heaven is an eternal spiritual kingdom affecting the external, not an external kingdom affecting the internal. So then we begin to look at the next part. He says, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. And we know what this means, that treasures of earth, that whatever we could put together on this earth is not going to last. It's all going to crumble. Those of you who are building your own house know this very well, because before you even get it finished, you're already repairing it. Can anybody join me in that? A couple of you? Good. Thank you. Appreciate that. See, it breaks down pretty fast. I found it interesting that the original translation is not where thieves break in and steal. The original translation says where thieves dig in or dig through and steal. It's interesting because in the Middle East, houses were made of dirt and bark and clay and dirt blocks. And so when you wanted to break into somebody's house, you just took your little shovel or your pick and you just chipped a hole in the wall, the back wall, and stole their goat or stole their lunch or whatever you were going to steal. So he's saying there, do not lay up for your treasures on earth where thieves can dig through and steal. So if you have a bank vault down low, this might apply in the original text, you know, where they dig in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. So the challenge is to treasure the treasures of heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, or thieves do not dig through and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Occasionally, I use an interlinear, I don't know if you know what that is, but it's got the Greek words and the English ones there together. And like all translation, Arnie was speaking Spanish to us, you know, there's no real equals for words. And sometimes they put the sentences backwards, the verb comes differently and all that. So it's kind of interesting, but I came across this one, which I kind of liked. It said, even though it's a little backward or old English for us, it says, wherefore is the treasure of thee, there will also be the heart of thee. I'll say it again just because it's kind of hard to understand. Wherefore is the treasure of thee, there will be also the heart of thee. And we understand that what that means. Where our treasure is, that's where our heart really goes. There's an old, can I say rock song? Is that a bad thing to say up here? There's an old, I don't know even who the group was, but it said, if you can be bought at any price, you will be. I just remember that phrase from the song. It's either Petra or Striper or somebody. Does anybody remember these groups? Is that, yeah, see, thank you for the, but anyway, if you can be bought at any price, you will be. See, the devil's really good at finding out what it is that we're going to treasure instead of what we should be treasuring. For some of you, money is not a temptation. The accumulation of stuff, you like stuff, but the accumulation of it is not that big a deal. You've heard of the hoarder, the guy who buys the artworks and hides them where only he or she can see them. Some of you, significance would be the big thing that you would want. You want to be significant. You will do anything to be significant. Anybody remember the watchwords Larry said his parents live by? What will people think? Remember that? I remember him sharing that with us. You have to be careful about being susceptible to that kind of mindset. If that's the kind of mindset you are, you're treasuring up their opinion of you more than you are God's opinion of you. This is the thing that we're commanded not to allow to happen here. We are not to lose our heart to treasure. Do not lose your heart to treasure, treasuring that treasure. That's a lot of treasures in one sentence, but if you lose your heart to treasure, treasuring that treasure, you will not understand the kingdom of heaven. We need to keep things in proper perspective. A believer operating correctly in the kingdom of heaven will be treasuring the treasures of heaven. Did he give us some insights into some of the treasures of heaven in passages prior to this? I think he did. I think we saw many things. We just saw what God valued in prayer versus what the world valued. We saw what God valued in giving as opposed to what the world valued. We saw what God valued in fasting as opposed to what the world valued. And before that, we saw what God valued in meekness and forgiveness and hungering and thirsting and mercy and pure in heart and peacemaker and poor in spirit and those who mourn. These are the things that should mark a Christ follower, a kingdom follower, and they should mark us. And we should not be one who treasures our treasures, but just keeps our things, our treasures, in their proper place. We know that the Jews continually focus on earthly things. And it's not hard for us to do. We have trials. We have inflation. We have troubles. We have taxes. Did everybody get their taxes in on time? These things cause us tension and worry, and we begin not to trust. Our heart begins to deviate from trusting God for them and to begin to treasure them. How can we get that? How can we do that? I do not shop on Black Friday. I was once in a mall on Black Friday, I must admit, and I bought a jacket for half price at an Eddie Bauer place. So I have succumbed once in my life to Black Friday. But I read the next day about the fist fights, you know what I'm talking about, and the brawls, and the, you know, I may be a little demented, but I'm not spending the night in front of Best Buy in a tent so I can get a video game the next morning at half price. Does anybody spend the night at Best Buy in a tent? I mean, go ahead and admit it. Maybe it's more valuable, but but see, to like those things is fine. I don't think that's what he's saying, but to treasure that up so much that you change your whole life and focus on the accumulation of these things. And if they're taken from you, your whole life is gone. Isn't treasuring up the way God asks us to treasure up? So I think we see the clear direction that he wants us to do. He wants us to draw close to him for our sustenance and not treasure these things up and not let them take the place, because they're not going to heaven with us. The only thing going to heaven with you that you know is the people, the young people and your fellow Christians who have made a decision to accept the atoning work of Christ. And so that's where our focus should be. Let's look at the second section. It gets even more challenging for me, although it's probably very simple for you. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Now there's an interesting phrase. If the light is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? You see that in some versions you have the word light three times in those two verses. In this you have the word light twice and the word lamp once. It's interesting to note, and this helps a little bit, but all three of those words are different words in Greek. So even though they're using the same words, they all have different meaning. So it lends itself to a little bit of a challenge. So let's look at the first phrase. The lamp of the body is the eye. So we can let lamp stand as it is. You move a lamp into a room that's dark. It sheds light into that room. It helps the eye see. It helps discern everything that's in that room. We want to keep in mind that the word body there in Middle Eastern culture means the entire being of a person, not just the body, but the soul and the spirit, the entire being. So the illumination of the entire being is the eye. Now, when you study the word eye, which is where it starts to get really tricky, there are a lot of potential meanings for that word in this context. But for this discussion right now, I'm going to stick with the concept of discernment, meaning that the light of the body is the discernment that you have. The discernment that you have is what comes into your being, your entire being, and gives you direction. It helps you to know, to have sight, to have wisdom, to have correct discerning of what's there. If you walk into a room with no lamp, you do not discern what it is there. All you discern is darkness. But if you have discernment, then you have vision. If therefore your eye is good. Now, if we substitute the word discernment, just for the sake of this discussion, we say, if therefore your discernment is good, your whole body will be full of light. And in this situation, the term light means truth or reality. So you would say, if therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of truth or reality. But let's go back to the word good for a moment. The word good in our culture is a meaningless word anymore. Good, what does good mean? But if you look this word up, it means single or singular focus. So it says, if your eye has a single focus, your body will be full of light or truth or reality. So I believe it's saying there that your discernment, if it has a single focus, and you see that both in the previous one, you can't lay up treasures for yourself in both places. And in the following one, you cannot serve God and mammon. Your eye must have a singular focus. If your eye has a singular focus, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, now we're not talking about the physical eye here. We're talking about if your discernment is bad. And by bad, what we mean here is multi-focused, meaning not singular focused on God, but trying to focus both on treasures and on God. And I think if we think about our own heart or the Christians we know or the church in general, we wouldn't say that the church in general in our country is focused on God, but it is focused on both God and mammon, the accumulation, the treasuring up of treasures. It is not a singular focus, but a multi-focus. So if your body is bad or multi-focused, then the whole body, the whole being will be full of darkness. And by darkness, it's obviously, it can mean blindness. If you walk into a room and you have no light, you have no correct discernment, then you are full of darkness. And if the light, and in this situation, the term light means the mind or the conscience, if therefore the mind and the conscience that is in you is blind, how great is that blindness? Now that got really complex for a really simple verse. But I don't know that you can get the really meaning out of the verse just by reading the term light three times. But if you understand mainly that he's talking about focusing totally on God, having a singular focus on spiritual things, the kingdom of heaven, then you will have not missed the meaning, regardless of how many of those other words I threw in there for you to understand. A lamp gives light into the room in the same way that good discernment gives light to our character, and we must have that. I'm going to read a paraphrase, and it might help and it might not. I like this from the Expositor's Greek Testament. He said, "The eye is the lamp of the body. When it is healthy, we see to do our daily work. When it is diseased, we are in darkness. So with the eye of the soul, the heart, the seat of desire, when it is free from covetousness, not anxious to hoard, all goes well with our spiritual functions. We choose and we act wisely. When sordid passions possess us, there becomes a darkness that is deeper than afflicts any blind man." What he's trying to say there is simply that we must focus on single idea of following God as closely as we possibly can, using the discernment that we have from the truth and reality that we know. And when we confuse those and we begin to seek other things, the darkness creeps in, and it is a crushing darkness. And we know this crushing darkness because we see it around us in our culture. We see it in our own lives. We know when we've lost it. I see it in my own life, and I'm desperately disappointed in myself often, because I should be so much more mature and so much more gracious to those around me, and I can be so immature and so worldly. And then he follows it with this next verse. "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve good God and mammon." So the challenge, of course, is not just to do, because that's not the way God challenges us. The challenge is, where is our heart? Where is our heart commitment? Where is our heart value? If you looked at us and say, are we treasuring up treasures, and that's our heart now, and we just assume he didn't interfere with our treasures, we've sort of missed the boat. If we're using the things God gave us to share the truth about God, we haven't missed the boat. If we have a singular focus on God and what he's doing in the kingdom of heaven and what that looks like and how we can be involved in that, we're doing what we are created to do. If we've lost that focus and now we're just looking at all sorts of things. And guys, I don't know that there's ever been a time when it's easier to lose focus. These little phones we pack around, these cable TVs, all that. I mean, they used to think because they had a book, books were out, that was a way to lose focus. And it is. But it's not like now. It takes a conscious effort to focus on God. It does not happen by chance. I was working with a young man this week in the high school who got himself in trouble. And it's a difficult situation. And he's a good kid as far as good kids go. But I said, it's like this. You didn't plan not to do it. It's not that they plan to do it, but they don't plan not to do it, so they do it. Does that make sense? It has to be intentional. This idea of a singular focus now, because the world pushes so hard, has to be intentional. It's not going to happen by chance. And if you have young kids and you want them to be singular focused on God, you're going to have to make some hard decisions in your home and in their life, because it's not going to happen by chance. There's too many disruptive things that make us just look to all sorts. I mean, there's kids running in the hall back there, and it's hard for me not to watch them. See, I get singular focus is lost. But the way to get that singular focus back, the cool thing is the veil was torn in two, right? And we get to go in and talk directly to God about it. In the cool of the evening, whatever that means to you, on your bed at night, when things finally slow down, you can talk to God. Say, God, what can I do about this? How could I be more focused? I felt like I loved this thing more than I loved you today. How can I refocus on loving you and caring for you, as opposed to being lost in the pursuit or falling off the edge of stupidity by just loving things? So that's a challenge for us to think about that. And I hope that you understand that a little bit better. I hope I didn't make it too difficult. But I think if you just read it through, you kind of get the overall feeling of it. But maybe a couple words there will help you understand a little more in depth. Let's pray. Lord, we know you gave us your word for us to learn from and to be able to have something we can see and try to understand what your heart is. Help us to see the Father in this, and then to show the Father to the world as we see it and understand it. Thank you for your graciousness and your incredible patience with us and kindness to us. In Jesus' name, amen.